The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Carla would have made a beautiful wife, a beautiful mom. She would have been a wonderful daughter to my mom and my dad, our parents. I think she would have been a wonderful sister, and the world is a sadder place because she's not here.
While researching Carla Walker's story in the Fort Worth Press and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, it became ridiculously obvious that to rely strictly on the press's rendition of her, the only thing to report would be she was pretty, popular, and had a bunch of friends. What wasn't difficult to find in the papers were the maddening details of the assault against her and her eventual murder, even down to sometimes unsubstantiated speculation of what she had gone through the days that she was unaccounted for. When a crime is committed against an individual, the media is more than willing to dish out the macabre details. The more gruesome and shocking and abhorrent the circumstances, the more likely the media is to attempt to sear the images into the masses' brains, providing the fodder necessary to nourish the morbid curiosity that is, apparently, a built-in component to the human condition. For some, it is tucked away deep down somewhere. For others, not so much. So, Fort Worth heard the story of a crime. But where was Carla's story? Where was the Walker's story? The scars that remain on the family members of a victim aren't superficial. The residual effect that a crime against a loved one causes a family is imperishable. Their narrative, their suffering, doesn't end when the press moves on to the next story. This episode, Media Norms Be Damned, the concentration will remain focused on understanding the devastation that the Walker family has lived with since Carla's murder. And, of course, the episode will attempt to provide an accurate representation of the life that was taken too soon. I've had the pleasure of becoming acquainted with Carla's sister, Cindy, fairly well over the course of preparing for Carla's story. She's the kind of person who makes you feel like you've known her forever. She's funny, sincere, and easy to talk to. Whenever we speak, we spend considerable time chatting and giggling about our experiences with our families. It became acutely obvious to me very quickly that Cindy's family, both here and gone, is immensely important to her. It's funny, as she described Carla's spirited and dynamic personality, I couldn't fight the feeling that the two were emphatically alike. Cindy, too, is candid and feisty and no-nonsense. Carla, in some indescribable way, lives on through Cindy. It was a strikingly emotional thing for me to grasp. She lit up when talking about her sister. The memories Cindy shared with me made it clear that the siblings' bond was impenetrable.
She was something else. She really was. We shared a room up until I was in eighth grade, so she would have been in sixth grade. We had a canopy bed, and we had her own desk and dressers. And one day she just decided that she was tired of sharing a room with me, didn't want me on her side of the room, and she got a black marker and took it down the headboard, a black marker, all the way on the mattress, down the end, said, "This is my side of the bed, that's your side of the bed, don't come over on my side." And I was like, Mother's going to kill you when she sees that. And she's like, no, that's my side of the bed. Don't get on my side of the bed. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. But that's how she was. She was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. Mark that off, and this is your side, and this is my side. I would have never thought about doing that, but she did it. We had a big old black marker Sharpie all the way from our headboard down to the end board, and that was her personality. She just stood up. She just did those things. I was too scared to do them. She was like, I'm doing this. This is what we're going to do. She just had this outgoing, stubborn. She was stubborn. She just stood her ground. She put her little old hands on her hips, raised her leg up and put it on her knee, and just, she would talk back, and I was scared to talk back to my dad, and she would just tell him, and so-and-so, and so-and-so, and this is what, and so-and-so, and I'd just like, oh my gosh, you're going to get us all in trouble. She never got in trouble. She had that personality that she was like, I'm moving forward, and this is how we're doing it. And the time that she had, like, my spider monkey that I had gotten, my dad built a cage for him, and Carla didn't like him being in the room, and every time she'd go by, she would tap his cage, and he would squeal at her. And then one day, I let him out to run around the room and stuff, and he went over and cleaned her dresser off, took all her little painted eggs and threw them and cracked them, and I thought, oh my gosh. She came home, she's like, that's it, I've had it. And she went back and started just pounding on his cage, and he was just squealing and running all over the cage. She just had this little fiery personality. You know, for the whole 17 years she was alive, we shared a room together, and we went to parties together, and our boyfriends were, you know, everybody was upstairs together, Rodney and my boyfriend, and we were all having a great time, and, you know, we all hung out and went and did things together, and, yeah, we had a good time. We'd go out to the lake together, and, I mean, we had a good relationship. I mean, we fought like siblings, but we still took care of each other, and yeah, I had a great relationship. So when I turned 16, I was happy just to get a car. I got a used car, it was a Cutlass, and I was happy with it. And well, she had said, when I turned 16, I want a brown Monte Carlo. And she said, so don't even bother looking for me a car, because if I don't get that brown Monte Carlo, I just don't get a car. And her birthday was in January, and she got it that June or July. Brand new brown Monte Carlo, and I was like, dang. She didn't get mad. She didn't get one when she was 16. She was fine. But that's what I want, brown Monte Carlo, and she got her Monte Carlo. And she just loved that car. I mean, that was what she wanted and had her mind made up and didn't pressure my parents, but she said, that's what I want, and so I'll just wait until y'all get it for me. And they got it for her. That was just her. That's how she was. And she wasn't like ugly about it or, you know, a spoiled brat. She was just like, that's what I want, and if I can't get it, I'll just wait. And she waited. She got it. She loved it. That was her car. You know, my parents, I mean, they never got mad at either one of us, really, because we really never did anything for them to get mad at us. But she was just, her little spitfire personality was, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to do it, and I'll wait. This is how it's going to be. And that was her. She always smiled and had a big old smile and, you know, 4'11", tiny little thing and blonde hair. And when she walked in a room, she just kind of, everybody knew she was there.
An important aspect of Cindy's recollections of Carla is the relationship that the thriving young woman had with her boyfriend, Rodney McCoy. For some reason, Carla's story seems incomplete without an understanding of the couple's relationship. And also an understanding of the bond that Rodney and the rest of the Walker family mutually held.
See, Rodney was a senior. She was a junior. And when they started dating, and he, you know, was the football quarterback, and he lived out in the Bembrook at the time. And they started dating, and actually we shared the same room, and Rodney was over there almost every night with his books studying, and my dad had some open-heart surgery down in San Antonio at the base there, and he went down there for the week with us and stayed down there in the officer's quarters while my dad was having his surgery. So he was like part of the family. I mean, he would go in, get something to drink. If he wanted something to eat, he'd go down and get it. He just became like part of the family, and it was just like a brother, I guess, to me, too. And they got along great. And I really can't remember them. I know they got mad at each other or fought, but I don't ever remember anything serious. I think he just listened. She was just a little dynamite. I think he listened to her. And, you know, they just settled their differences. But they got along great. They just didn't seem to argue a lot, and any more than normal kids would at that age. So, he was good in school, and he was just a lot of fun to be around. And like I said, we all went out the lake together, and Rodney would go, and he went on trips with us. So he had become part of our family.
Cindy's memory of the night of Carla's abduction is as clear as you would expect a traumatic, unfathomably life-changing event to be. Details are lost only as the result of the chaos and confusion that inevitably took place during the tragedy, but the memory remains mostly intact. Not a day has passed that Cindy isn't tormented by that cool February night.
I was at home, and my cousin and my aunt and uncle were in town, and we were all in there. My aunt and uncle and my mom and dad were playing dominoes. My cousin and I were talking and everything, and the doorbell started ringing, just ding, 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 and kind of, you know, knocking, ding, 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 because we had one of those glass doors on the front door. So I opened the front door, and it was Rodney, and he had blood coming down his face, and he was just like beside himself, and he was saying, "They've got her, they've got her, they got her." "What? Well, who are you talking about?" And finally he says, "You know, somebody took her out of the car at the bowling alley," and we got him in the house and looked, and he called the ambulance, called the police, and he just kept saying, "They got her, they got her." And he had driven from the bowling alley to my parents' house with no lights on, and he just pulled through their driveway almost halfway into the grass. He was so, you know, scared and upset and traumatized by it. And he went down to the hospital in the ambulance, and then the Benbrook police came. And at that time, we lived in Benbrook, but right across the street was Fort Worth, where the bowling alley was. And so it was out of Benbrook's jurisdiction, so we should have really called Fort Worth, but we didn't think about that at the time. So I think we lost some time during that, you know, between the police and trying to get, because by the time they got there, and I just feel like we lost a lot of time trying to get, you know, who the right officers and law enforcement should be during all that. My dad, immediately when Rodney said somebody grabbed her and took her out of the car and they've taken her, he went and got his pistol, and he drove up to the bowling alley. And, you know, obviously nobody was there. But if there had been somebody there, there is no doubt in my mind they wouldn't have been alive, because he didn't even wait around to hear the whole story. He just grabbed his gun and drove straight up to the bowling alley.
Cindy and the rest of the Walker family weren't capable of contemplating that the worst fate would fall on Carla. Life without her seemed impossible to imagine.
I really think we thought somebody had taken her. At that time, you didn't hear a lot about kidnapping. So I think in all of our minds, we really thought somebody would drop her off at the house or drop her somewhere. And I just remember it was very, very cold. And I slept down on the couch every night. I didn't go back upstairs except to change clothes after that. And the wind was blowing. It was just bitterly cold. And every time a car would go past our house, I would sit up on the couch and look out the window thinking, they'll just throw her out, or they'll drop her off, or push her out, or whatever. I really don't think my parents, none of us, I don't ever think this would be the end of it. We didn't think that would happen. Maybe all of us in the back of our minds. I know I didn't. I really never thought she would have been killed. I just couldn't imagine what would happen, but I don't think I ever thought that somebody would kill her. And my parents, if they did, they never, to us or to me or any of my siblings, they never did say what they thought might happen. I'm sure that it was in their mind, but they just didn't mention it. The doorbell rang, and we answered the door, and my mom came walking down the hall, and she went to the door, and they were like, "Miss Walker, what do you think about them finding Carla?" And she was like, "What? What are you talking about?" Yeah, we just got word they found her. Yeah, she had been murdered. And my mom, she just shut the door. And they had heard it on the police scanner. And then not too long after, the police did show up. And I think it was the sheriff's department that showed up because they found her out in the county. So, yeah, we had no idea that they had even located her or any of that until that reporter showed up and told us that.
Closure is a concept, a luxury that people believe in until they have undergone a loss that decimates their heart and soul. Since Carla's homicide has not been solved, the Walker family was not only affected by the initial trauma of that tragedy, but continued to live with the scourge of uncertainty and lingering anguish that it created. And Cindy's life, her entire life, has been, unfortunately, partially defined by the affliction forced upon her entire family.
It changed our whole dynamics. The way we lived as a family, the way we gathered together. I mean, we were all still together, but you noticed she was absent. She just wasn't there anymore, and we knew that. But it just changed the way that my dad treated me. Like, he became so much more protective. As far as, we didn't have cell phones back then. So it was like, as soon as you get home, call me. Or as soon as you go somewhere, call me. And I was getting married 3 months later, and Carla was to be my maid of honor. And so it just ruined that whole time. I say ruin it. It wasn't the same because I wanted her in my wedding, and I just, we all missed her. We all knew something was missing. And after that, then you really start to think about what happened to her, what she must have gone through. You know, that, I think that was probably the hardest thing for us to get over, was what did she have to go through and what they did to her. I don't know. And Christmases were sad, her birthday, and it just, it left a hole for us. And we always were so sad about what happened to her. I don't know how to explain that, how, you know, it hurt all of us so deeply that she had to go through that. And knowing her personality and how happy she always was, that, you know, we never could comprehend what had happened to her and how, I think that was the deepest part of our whole, with what happened to her and how it happened. And it was really about how bad she was hurt, that hurt us so bad. And that was, you know, it's a hard thing to get over. It takes a long time to get over that. To this day, I can still remember the first time I saw her at the funeral home. It's just imprinted, you know, in your brain, and it just doesn't go away. You just always remember that and thinking, why, you know, it's, and then you, in your mind, you know, you make, because we haven't had any solid answers, so in our mind, you just have, you imagine these things, or what could have happened, or what they did, or where she was at, and I think that's been the hardest part for all of us, and mainly the why. Why her? It happened, and, you know, she suffered. So no matter how much grief we went through or how much we suffered after, we can't imagine, you know, what she went through. And we always tried to keep that in the back of our mind, or, you know, when we talked about it. But we never talked about the nitty-gritty part of it. I think we all knew what had happened. We just knew. And from that day on, it was really pretty much, unless the police were there or asked questions, was about her as a person. Remember the time she did this? Remember when she did that? Oh, Carla would be mad if she was here and we were doing this. And that's kind of how we moved forward.
Carla's brother Jim was young when his sister was torn away from his life. Their relationship was what you might expect from a brother and a sister 5 years removed. It was completely normal in its rivalry and discord. But since Carla was Jim's nearest sibling, she held the lion's share of his affinity.
My oldest sibling was 13 years older than me. Carla was 5 years older than I was. So she's dating, Cindy's dating, he's got boyfriends, you know. So I'm the bratty little brother, right? And so Carla loved to antagonize me. She's just my sister. I mean, I wish I could tell you I had these Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver type, you know, feelings. I knew I loved her. I knew she was my sister. But I think out of all my siblings, she would every once in a while would take me to go get Coke or go do something. But I think we, you know, we were probably appropriate in our relationship at that time as probably not any different than most other families. But I thought she was beautiful. But she was a spitfire, and she would stand her ground, and she would let you know what she thought of it. But every once in a while, Dad would get, you know, a little bit snippy. And Carla, I remember her standing toe-to-toe with him, just giving him what for, and he didn't say anything. He just looked at her. You could tell. You could tell he was thinking to himself, she's right. Carla genuinely loved people. She loved her family. But, you know, at that time in her life, she was 17, starting to experience life, love, romance, you know, school. She was a good student from what I remember. She was a popular girl from what I remember. She was a good daughter, and I would say from my perspective, she was a good sister.
His memories of the evening of Carla's abduction are clear, and due to his age at the time, his perspective is unique.
You know, I didn't have the life experience or the skills to process it very well. So I felt a lot like an observer, and I watched a lot, but I do remember I was scared. I was scared, and I didn't know what, I really didn't understand what kidnapping was, but I knew it was bad because I saw Rodney's face. I remember hearing something hit the curb, and I thought to myself, wow, you know, somebody just had a wreck. And I remember hearing a screeching, like a door that was not oiled, screeching open as it was opened. And, you know, we could hear something coming up into the front yard. I remember that door, hearing that screech, and we were inside. And it was a cool night. It wasn't real cold, but it was a cool night. And I remember that screech, and I remember hearing the door open, and I remember hearing, Mr. Walker, help me. They've got her. They're going to hurt her bad, Mr. Walker. They've got her. And then pounding on the front door, the screen door. As I remember it, I ran to the door, and my sister ran to the door. Don't hold me to that. I know everybody, we're all running to the door, right? And the door opened, and looking through the screen, you know, you could see Rodney. I mean, he had crested blood, panic. I mean, just pure panic. Well, that was what I saw in Rodney's face, pure fear and panic. It was, he had like a big fillet where something had ripped across his cheek, blood coming down his forehead, but it was kind of dried. It wasn't really bleeding, kind of like it had coagulated. Of course, I didn't know what that was at that time, but I remember it. And then, of course, we got in the door, and he was screaming, Mr. Walker, they've got her. And Dad immediately took him into the kitchen, set him down, and he told me, Jimmy, go get a rag or go get a washcloth. And I went and got a washcloth. Rodney said, no, somebody took her. Somebody took Carla. And, you know, Dad was moving at that point. He got his gun and took off to, found out where they were and took off. I mean, he just flew up there. So that's the way it ended. That part of the evening, the normalcy ended that way. And, of course, everybody's panicking. My mom and dad were, stoic, right? And not panicking, not, you know, Dad was moving very quickly. At that point, all hell broke loose. So I remember for the 3 days, you know, we were, I don't know that my parents ever slept. We had law enforcement in and out of the house, tons of people. Wouldn't surprise me if the asshole that did this actually came to the house or drove by the house. It wouldn't surprise me. We had so many people coming in and out of the house. As I recall, I remember a lot of weapons. I remember a lot of people showing up ready. But there's a lot of searching for Carla.
12-year-old Jim was taught the cruelty of life far too early, and in a way in which most of us will never experience, let alone comprehend. When Carla was found, he accompanied his parents to the morgue to identify her body.
And I remember we went to the morgue with the Michaels. They're both deceased now. They were my mom and dad's best friends here. And we went with the Michaels up to the morgue, to the coroner's office, just the visual identification. And I was with them. Of course, I didn't go in. I remember pulling up. the doors were open. I remember my mom and dad meeting somebody and walking down this long hall and going into a room, and the windows were down, and I was outside in the Michael's car, and I remember hearing that death scream, and I'll never forget that for the rest of my life. But it's that scream when a parent sees their dead child who'd been slaughtered. So I remember hearing that. And then I remember shortly after that, dad walking out with mom, his arm around her, and he never said anything. So that's what I remember happening that night.
Jim's age also provided him with an everyday reminder of the perpetual mourning his parents suffered from. Naturally, he was the last sibling of Carla's to leave the Walker home. Of course, losing his sister to such violence and depravity has had a long-lasting effect on Jim's life.
The only time I ever saw my dad tear up and some tears come down his face, not crying. I mean, I'd probably been crying like a babbling idiot. That's the only time I ever saw him tear up, but he didn't cry. But I saw my mom go through chronic clinical depression. Today, if something like that was happening, you have every freaking person in the world wanting to do search, wanting to do therapy, wanting to do group counseling, wanting to do support groups. You know, back in 1974, you just sucked it up, buttercup, and you dealt with it. They didn't talk. You know, remember I told you at the beginning, my parents were very stoic. After that happened, I saw from 74 to probably 79, I saw my mom really battle. She didn't do drugs. She didn't do, alcohol. I saw her battle with depression. Mom had a lot of suffering. She had she suffered in silence a lot. And she went through a lot of pain. She lost another daughter in a car wreck in 1953 or 4. No, Sharon Kay. Her name was Sharon Kay. She lost her in a car wreck, got hit by some older lady that in West Texas. Her and my dad were coming back from West Texas where my mom's family was from. During a windstorm, sandstorm, and got rear-ended and broke mom's pelvis, shattered her pelvis, but threw Sharon out the window. She was a 18-month-old baby. There's a few things, that were talked about, but basically investigation, let's find this person. We never talked about both of my parents, I believe, suffered in silence, and for a majority of that, they suffered in silence alone and not together. I know my dad suffered terribly as well. But he was, like I said, he was a warrior. He'd seen hell and havoc during World War II. Losing Carla changed the trajectory of most of our lives, I believe. I became very hostile and bitter, super overprotective, lots of fights, very aggressive on people. I think about my sister Carla on a weekly basis. I think about all the horror that she had to go through. I think about the fear and panic in her eyes, knowing what's coming. I think about all that, and as I think about it, I've given grace to this guy, and I've forgiven him. I would love to hear the word guilty with solid evidence or a confession. I don't care if the guy's on his deathbed. He still has eaten steaks. He still has had sex. He still has bought cars, gone on vacation. Maybe he found Jesus, right, and raised a great family. Who knows? But I'd like to have a informed conclusion to this, but I will tell you, if he came to my front door and identified who he was and showed me proof, I can't tell you. I wouldn't say, why don't you come in? He would never be seen again. One of the things I tried to tell my mom is we're going to find him before you leave this earth. I will always regret not being able to fulfill that promise.
The apprehension, the unanswered questions, the nagging speculations. These things have taken a hard toll on the Walkers. Carla's abductor and killer has remained a fugitive from justice for over 43 years.
I think the main thing that's always bothered us is it was not your typical kidnap and murder. Then it got to where the police department would call ever so often. It's like, we're still working on it. We don't have any leads. We never got phone calls back. It just became very frustrating. And there were several times my parents, they kind of took it upon themselves to try to start getting answers and looking at things. And I don't understand it either. I mean, it's like after 43 years, you'd think they want to give everything they have out there, because the one part they're holding back could be what's most important. At this point, what does it hurt?
Because where Carla's body is in proximity, here's what I think happened. Carswell Air Force Base was a rally or a mustering point where troops would come in, they would get debriefed, they would dispatch to other posts. It would not surprise me if this guy who Rodney saw maybe was from this area but was of military age. You know, we've got a military base 3 miles down the road from where Carla was taken, and you got a clean-cut military-style guy. I have a feeling it's somebody from this area who was probably back here, because somebody has to know that that is not someplace you just go. You got to know it's at nighttime, because that ditch was well hidden at nighttime. It's hard enough to see during the day. Somebody knows something out there. Somebody knows something.
If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Detective Jeremy Roden at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, the evidence and the investigation. We'd like to sincerely thank Cindy and Jim for their contributions to this episode. It has been an incredible experience getting to know Carla and the Walker family, and it would have been impossible without their help. You can subscribe and download Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Auto Radio, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Twitter or Facebook by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we will post pictures about the case, including one of Carla and Cindy. Please join. If you would like to support the show, please subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, and share with a friend or stop by our Patreon page. We've received our first Patreon donations this past week and would like to thank them for their support. Thank you, Kimberly S. from Texas, and also a thank you to the Minds of Madness podcast team. The Minds of Madness podcast is an investigative discovery, uncovering the series of events, circumstances, and state of mind which cause ordinary people to do unthinkable things. If you haven't checked them out, please give them a listen. We'd also like to say thanks to the following podcasts for their support. Already Gone, the Derailers Podcast, our fellow Texas podcasters, Secret Transmission Podcast, the Nowhere Dispatch, and the TX Files. And last, but definitely not least, Misconduct, a true crime podcast hosted by Colleen and Eileen, and sometimes Nicole. Each week they discuss facts, theories, and their opinions of resolved and unresolved crimes, wrongful convictions, and miscarriages of justice. So make sure you subscribe today if you haven't already. And if you're like us and love reading about fascinating true crime cases, please visit truecrimefiles.com. Thanks for listening, y'all. Talk to you next week.
It came through the mail without ribbons or bows. No name on the card, but its message was clear. Stolen rose, kissed by a tear. Hours, but with pockets so bare. Little would know, but to my lady fair, no costly gift of elaborate display could ever replace this bouquet. So the story, with its moral, begs forgiveness, still's a quarrel. Loving me one stolen rose, this rose garden thief, to her memory a slave. May one crimson rose save our love from a grave. God who walks among flowers where love blooms and grows, please pardon this one. Still's a quarrel.